Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. The woke madness in history education is off the rails. Well, how do we change it? McClanahanacademy.com. And because you listen to this podcast, if you use the coupon code PODCAST at checkout, you get 25% off every day, all day, 365 days a year on every class at McClanahanacademy.com. So go to McClanahanacademy.com, use coupon code PODCAST at checkout, and get a real history education at 25% off. If you like this podcast and you want it without advertisements, head over to patreon.com and become a member of the Brian McClanahan Show. For $10 a month, you get all the podcasts ad-free, including video, and you also get a special Q&A podcast. I'm only going to answer your questions, your listener-generated episodes, through those Q&A. So, head over to patreon.com. Get this podcast ad-free, no ads, not even things like this, and you really do help support the Brian McClanahan Show with really cool stuff on the back end. If you follow me for some time, you know I write a lot about the South, and my book, Southern Scribblings, is a collection of many of those essays. It's a great book. You're really going to want it. It tells you why I think the Southern tradition should be preserved and why it should be respected. Get Southern Scribblings at Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com, wherever books are sold online. You're really going to love it. Is there a new right manifesto in American conservatism? We'll talk about that on this episode of The Brian McClanahan Show.
It's time to think locally and act locally. Welcome to The Brian McClanahan Show.
Welcome back to The Brian McClanahan Show. Back on the program. Very glad to be here. All right. Well, I want to talk about something that I think has been brewing now for a couple of years. But in reality, this has been going on now for about, I don't know, 70 years. And it's an evaluation of what American conservatism is. Now, I just had a class at McClanahan Academy on this, American conservatism. And that class will come up for sale again. You'll never get it for the deal that I had it when I launched it. So you need to be on my email list to get that. But regardless, this debate about what is the meaning of American conservatism, I think is something that, gosh, it only happens on the right. It only happens on, lefties don't worry about this stuff. They don't worry about what it means to be an American leftist. But American conservatives get so pedantic about what it means to be an American conservative that we debate each other incessantly about this meaning of liberal or Lockean or conservative even. What do these terms even mean? Now, this is an important debate. Now, don't get me wrong. It is important. Lefties don't worry about it because of the ongoing measure of progress. It really doesn't matter. They can just discard whatever they want and go on to the next thing because, well, it's a revolutionary movement. You always got to be moving forward. Conservatives want to restrain, but where do we stop? Where does that end? And what things do we tear out? So at the website im1776.com, there has been a discussion over the last several months about this. A couple of years ago, I had a discussion with the West Coast Straussians through Chronicles magazine on this very topic. But we can go back to the 1970s with Harry Jaffa and, of course, Mel Bradford discussing this. What is equality a conservative principle? And we can also go back to the 1950s when there was a conversation about this. The post-war period has seen an ongoing conversation about what it means to be an American conservative. Now, in this issue at IM1776, there was a debate between Chris Arufo and Curtis Yarvin, about conservatism. And it was, you know, a written debate. They went back and forth and then the magazine published it. And it's very hard to read, I think, at times because Yarvin is a strange writer. Rufo was better at presenting his ideas. And in fact, he published another piece at IM1776. Let me get to that. It's entitled The New Right Activism. The New Right Activism. This is 2024. Now, that title struck me as interesting, and it's interesting to me for a number of reasons. First, that we're dusting off this phrase, New Right, like it's something new. And in fact, I'm going to hold up a book that was published in 1982, right? So we're talking about 42 years ago. And what's the title of the book? Well, The New Right Papers. The New Right Papers. That was new. What was to contrast it from the old? You go back to this particular time period, we started looking at the splicing of conservatism into paleoconservatives and neoconservatives. Well, neoconservatives would actually signify there's a new conservatism, a new right, as contrasted against the old right. What do these terms actually even mean? For Rufo to come out and say we have a new right activism, well, that would mean that there's some kind of old right. What is that old right? Or is it a new kind of right-wing activism? I mean, what does it actually mean? These are the new right papers. Is it? Now, in that case, in that sense, it was a new right that had been formed because of Ronald Reagan in 1981 or 80-81. There was going to be this new coalition. In fact, the lead essay by William Rusher outlines this. There's this new coalition. Now, that goes back to the fusionism that was there before this point. People like M. Stanton Evans, who argued for fusionism. That was his whole idea. Let's put together some of these other groups like libertarians and alt-right conservatives and make this fusion movement. We're going to go out and we're going to talk about conservative ideas. So you see, all of these things we're just regurgitating the old fights. And I know that I'm a part of that because I think it's important to come up with these old fights. But the problem is, and even Whitaker, who edited this book, who's now deceased, pointed this out. There is a third rail. And this is what Lafayette Lee, who is one of the editors at I'm 1776, said on a social media post. There's a third rail, and it's the South. It's the third way. You see, Yarvin and Rufo are arguing from, you know, a monarchist perspective, Christian nationalist, or a nationalist perspective against a West Coast Straussian position. And all of these things have to deal with history. This is the important part of American conservatism. We're looking for a viable tradition, an anchor that holds it there. That's what it's all about. What is the viable heritage? Is America even conservative at all? It's something I've asked on this podcast before. It's something I've talked about. If you go back to Lewis Hart's, and you have to wrestle with that book. And of course, a couple of months ago, I talked about this with an essay by Paul Gottfried. You see, Chronicles Magazine has been dealing with this stuff for years. But Gottfried wrote an article. He said, look, I've pretty much abandoned the Hartsian thesis. And then he was discussing John Adams. And you have someone like Yarvin who thinks John Adams is just this rock-rib conservative. And then you've got Sam Adams, who's a liberal. You know what Yarvin has done there? He's adopted the Hartsian thesis. Now, Rufo refuted that, which is to his credit. I think he should. But we're all dealing with New England at that point. Why? Why are we dealing with New England? There's a whole other section in the United States that should have been paid attention to as the anchor for American conservatism. This is what Lafayette Lee pointed out. He said, wait, we don't have to look at this as the West Coast Straussians where, you know what, there's the bad South. Now, Yarvin's not so critical of the South, but he certainly is New England-centric. Southerners were not monarchists. In fact, they were pretty ardent in their support for the American War for Independence. And you look at the period after the war is over, and you find there were a lot of Southerners who were certainly interested in the French Revolution and tearing down the monarchy. When you had citizen Edmund Genet come over to the United States, and he started signing up Americans to serve as pirates against British shipping, where did he find most of his support? Well, in the South. Now, he had a huge welcome in Pennsylvania, too. But this is what he traveled through the South first. And these people loved him. They loved Genet. He's coming in here. Yes, these are our old friends. You've got Lafayette, who spent time throughout the United States, of course, friends with Hamilton, but also with Washington. But when he traveled to the U.S. in 1826, he was treated as a hero. Ferried across the Chattahoochee River in Georgia into the new state of Alabama on the shoulders of people in a throne, essentially. I mean, it's amazing what they did for this guy. The state of Alabama at that point spent a huge amount of money just to have him wined and dined in this new, you know, 7-year-old state at that point. But they loved the French. It didn't mean they were radical French revolutionaries. It didn't mean, and this is what Clyde Wilson has pointed out with the French and the English and what Americans North and South thought of this. Jefferson was comfortable in Virginia because he didn't think people were going to go out and guillotine him. But New Englanders were always worried about their own mob. It was something different. Jefferson was comfortable among the citizens of Virginia. Not subjects, but citizens. So I want to get into actually an essay that was written in that 1982 book, The New Right Papers, by Tom Fleming, who for decades was the editor at Chronicles Magazine. And he still has his Fleming Foundation. He still writes. Brilliant man. Somebody that, this is what Lee said, we need new young activists or new young writers to go out and really start thinking about the Southern tradition. I agree with that. It's important. There is a third way. It's something that the Abbeville Institute has been talking about for 20 years. It's something that people like Clyde Wilson and Tom Fleming and Sam Francis and others, I mean, look, on the Southern side of things, have been saying for a long time. And what Francis does in this essay is important, because immediately when you say the Southern tradition, the charge of race is going to be brought out. And he says, well, look, all right, so let's think about this logically in America. Is there anyone in America who can run from the stain, if we're just going to look at American history, from the stain of the charge of racism or slavery? Is there anyone, North or South, that can do it, other than the abolitionists? And if you go down that path, well, then what you've done is essentially adopt a 19th century leftist position for American history, and you've conceded the field. If you accept what the Republican Party always is, and of course Lee started this conversation because of Vivek Ramaswamy, who said that we need to have essentially an ideological America. And Lee said, you can't do that, because that's the proposition nation. If you accept this, then you concede the field to the left, because what you have done is said America has always been an idea. It's always been a leftist place. It's hearts. Once you go down that path, that's where you get. So what Fleming does, which is great, he says, okay, look, so we had Southerners who owned slaves. Yeah. We had Northerners who trafficked in them and made a lot of money. We had Southerners who had pretty vicious policies when it came to the separation of the races. We had Northerners who did the same thing. In fact, this is a national issue. It's not just a Southern issue, but a national issue. And this is what the 1619 Project, by the way, points out. It's where I've said that they were, in many ways, right about these things. They weren't incorrect. They weren't incorrect that you had an America that wasn't committed to the proposition nation. Ever, really. I mean, that's the whole point. That's what I've tried to say many times. We were never committed to that, and they're correct about that. And you know what? That was okay. Because it's ideological. The 1607 Project, which we're producing at Abbeville Institute, is going to deal with this in a little more concrete language. But it's okay that we weren't committed to that. Now let me get into this essay, and I'm going to focus on a couple of parts of it that Tom brings up in it. I don't have time to read the whole thing in a 30-minute podcast. It's a long essay. And the title again is Old Rights and the New Right. Old Rights and the New Right. And he actually begins with a quote from John C. Calhoun from 1838. Again, if you want to get back to the heart of American conservatives, you got to look at two individuals. One is Calhoun, the other is Randolph. And if you want to put three in there, the triumvirate, you put in John Taylor of Caroline. Those are the three. You go beyond that and you're really missing the point about American conservatism. Washington was a conservative who didn't really want to tear down the old order. He just wasn't going to be part of a monarchy. And again, Southerners were committed to a non-monarchist position. They're not monarchists. This whole American infatuation with monarchy is just silly. They're Republicans with a lowercase r. That wasn't leftist. You could even say it's older than the British order or the European monarchical order because they're going back to Greece and Rome. Calhoun talked about it all the time. It's older than that. Now, we know that Romans had a certain monarchical streak and they had a somewhat of a monarchy in their constitution. We know the Greeks had monarchies. We know this happened. But when you look at what the Romans eventually established with the consuls and the tributes and everything else, we know that they had established a kind of anti-monarchical order, at least some type of elected system where it wasn't just hereditary. And that's what Americans were looking at when they drafted and ratified the Constitution. This is what they were talking about. But this quote from Calhoun, he says, this is Calhoun now. The South, the great conservative power, which prevents other portions less fortunately constituted from rushing into conflict. And this tendency to conflict in the North between labor and capital, which is constantly on the increase, the weight of the South has and will ever be found on the conservative side. Against the aggression of one or the other side, which ever may tend to disturb the equilibrium of our political system. The great conflict at Calhoun was the tendency between labor and capital. Now, that would sound a lot like Karl Marx. In fact, this is what Hofstadter said. John C. Calhoun, the Marx of the master class. Calhoun understood class, he understood race, he understood all of these things. There were conflicts in society. Interests clamoring for power. That's what government was all about. And in this case, you have Rufo saying the same thing in his New Right Activism. He says that's true. I mean, government is never going to be neutral. Calhoun understood that. Conservatives have long understood that. Government cannot be neutral. Now, I've advocated federalism because the central authority in America, as constituted and as ratified, as defended by proponents of the document, was supposed to be neutral. Because it had such limited power, it couldn't do anything wrong. There could be no harm to come from it. That's how it was argued. Now, we know the antis, the real federalists, said, well, this is just bunk. That's not going to happen. Of course, they're going to abuse power. This thing is structured to do it. They were told they were wrong over and over. And if we're going to go by the Constitution as ratified, that's the one we need to pay attention to. Not the one that eventually we got, which is what we have, we're looking at now. I mean, that's what Joseph Story in his commentaries on the Constitution said we're going to have. I mean, that's the real Constitution, but that's not correct. That's the problem. So I want to read about two or three pages of this, maybe four, of this essay. And it's something that I actually assigned when I did my American Conservatism live class. Now, I didn't assign it in the on-demand class, but on the live class. The live classes are fun because we get to do some other things. But I want to get into some things that Tom Fleming says here. He says, it is not surprising, then, that the strongest support for social conservatism is still in the South, or that Southern senators like Helms, Thurman, and the newly elected John East are the leading traditionalists in the Congress. Indeed, the struggle between economic and social conservatives has been portrayed as a sectional conflict between North and South. Now, what did he just say there? Leading traditionalists. In fact, it was a question. You know, what do we call ourselves if conservative is the wrong word? I've used the term American traditionalist for years. Since, I don't know, over a decade, I've used that term. I don't think we should look at conservative or liberal But American, and it has to be a distinction there, an American traditionalist, it wouldn't say that there is, there's a European traditionalist, there's European populism, there's American populism. There are distinctions. And so, what are American traditionalists looking to conserve? What is the American tradition? Well, I think at the core of it, it's the most important thing, is federalism. You have to accept that we have a federal republic. And that in a federal republic, you're going to have differences manifested with conflicts between states, and that's okay. You see, the other way is much more violent. And I'll be reviewing this film, Civil War, at some point. Maybe this week, maybe next week, whenever I can get around to watching it. Hopefully it's this week, but we'll see. So then Fleming says this, which is very important. The struggle for power, then, is not a bilateral conflict between liberals like Ted Kennedy and conservatives like Ronald Reagan. It is a trilateral, pardon the expression, war going on among three groups. First, those who call themselves liberals, but whose doctrines and policies are nearly pure socialism, true. Second, free enterprise conservatives whose doctrines are unadulterated liberalism. And the traditionalists, social conservatives whose leadership and support is typically, but by no means exclusively, Southern. Now, notice what he did. There's a third way. There's a third rail. You basically have two groups, liberals and conservatives, arguing over the same exact thing, the proposition nation. You have the West Coast Straussians arguing with the liberals over the real meaning of the original Republican Party. Who was Abraham Lincoln? You have Harry Jaffa arguing with conservatives over, look, Lincoln really is conservative. And then the left is saying, well, no, he's not. Yes, he is. No, he's not. Yes, he is. This is how stupid it all is. When you accept Lincoln and the 19th century Republican Party as the basis of American conservatism, the proposition nation, you lost because you've conceded the field to them. This is what Fleming says. And you've got the other way. Now, where does Yarvin fit in? Yarvin is a European kind of conservative. It's not even an American brand of it. This is the charge against John Adams. He was a monarchist. He wasn't really even that in line with American values in many ways. Now, I mean, was Adams that? Was he something else? He wasn't certainly of the American mind, even though he did support, of course, the American War for Independence, the Declaration. I mean, he was 100% behind it. But his book on the Constitution, I mean, look, Virginians tore that thing apart. They ripped it apart. The antis ripped it apart. Were the antis on the left, or were they something else? That's another question to ask. You have some of the old historians, people like Herbert Storing and others, saying that the antis were just a bunch of leftists. I mean, they were all interested in the rights of the working man. Well, this is what Tom Fleming says the right is in. John C. Calhoun is interested in. Is Calhoun then just a mind of the master class? Is he just a leftist like Victor Davis Hanson says he is? No. He's a conservative. Look at what Calhoun says. The South, the great conservative power, which prevents other portions, less fortunately constituted, from rushing into conflict. The South, the great conservative power, which prevents these things from going into conflict. Now, it would say, well, yeah, but he's just defending slavery at that point. Southerners did think they had a way out of this labor conflict, and they were wrong. But that's what they thought. I mean, they were looking at the great conflicts in society. What do we have? We have conflicts between capital and labor. We have conflicts between different forms of power and government. Calhoun addressed that with the concurrent majority. How do we handle this? He was always worried about power. And again, Rufo, to his credit, is right in this new right activism. Government's always going to be power. It's always going to be abused. You have to come up with some way. And in his mind, we got to control it. And by controlling it, we got to use it. Now, what Calhoun would say was that's wrong. we should restrict it so severely that no one can use it. This is the concurrent majority. Because once you use it, I mean, what Rufo and others are saying now is that, well, we're just going to use the tools they've given us, and we're going to go after them like they go after us. What happens? Calhoun could see it. Yeah, you might get breaks where conservatives are going to control it. But 9 times out of 10, it's going to be them. And we're more likely to get left-wing fascism and despotism and tyranny than we are anything else. So we should try to restrict this thing. And why were you likely to get that? Because of emotion, which Rufo does point out. Emotion is key. Emotional arguments are important. Emotion. It's a powerful thing. Lefties win in the realm of emotion. And they win with hypotheticals. But let's keep going with this. The one issue on which the three groups most sharply disagree is the old question of the rights of man, rights which the South is supposed to have denied her people for the basest of reasons. And this is what I've talked about. All these people, they're the rights of man. It's all it is. Southerners are just these horrible people. And again, if you go back and look at the 1776 Commission report, that's it. He says, complaints against the South's racism cannot be taken seriously. They do, however, point to the real source of contention between true and false conservatives. The typical Northern capitalist, as glimpsed at Republican conventions and suburban cocktail parties, is a strong defender of what he likes to call free enterprise, by which he too often means a government-encouraged monopoly or oligopoly of business interests. He stands up for America against the menace of the Soviet communists. The Soviets believe in redistributing the wealth, although he is not averse to turning a profit from trading with countries behind the Iron Curtain. He deplores all forms of social welfare except those that benefit his own class as paternalism, thereby managing to forget that it was his ancestors' greed and rapacity that forced this country to turn socialist. Religion, he is heard to argue, is a very good thing, so long as it is not contaminated by fanaticism. His ancestors would have called it enthusiasm, the besetting of sin of Southern Baptists and traditional Roman Catholics up north. He's saying, so this is the people making these claims. Now you can throw in, I think this is important, this is 1982 now. He's talking about the cocktail party conservative. These are things we have to, the acceptable conservative, Mitt Romney. Think of Mitt Romney or Mike Pence. So these people are. They're going to say the right things at times. I mean, yeah, I can read the West Coast Straussians on some things. I say, yeah, that sounds right. What you're saying is right there. I mean, that's not wrong. But again, their anchor is wrong. It's obvious to anyone that many capitalist conservatives are nothing better than 19th century liberals with a hangover. Their libertarian ideas of freedom, expressed almost always in economic terms, are tempered only by the recognition that it takes force to keep the discontented masses in their place. However, when a Southerner calls himself a conservative, he is usually thinking of a way of life, of a social and moral order for which the people of the 1860s went to war. This is the third way. So when a Northerner thinks about it, he's just thinking of it like a 19th century liberal. But conservatives, there's another way. A way of life. He is more disturbed by the disintegration of the family than by rising interest rates. He believes in free enterprise and might even be happy to go to war to resist Soviet aggression. But he is not so delighted with the mobility and tawdriness of modern life, with the fast food and fast buck artists who seem intent on turning the New South into a suburb of Chicago. He does not like to see family farms swallowed up by agribusiness in the interest of profit and productivity. Above all, he knows the value of stability and the price of progress. Now, some would call this romantic or utopian. But that's not what it is. He's looking at things as they are. You can go back to the 1860s. Go back to the Copperheads, even in the North. I mean, this was an American strain. It wasn't just Southerners just held on to it longer than anyone else. Northerners, there were Northerners who thought this way too. In fact, they called themselves conservative. You go back and look at that Constitutional Union Party. The Constitution as it is. And the Union as it... For the Constitution, Union as it was, the Constitution as it is. I mean, they're arguing for the Constitution, maintaining that, and keeping the Union. It's conservative. One of the most perplexing things about most Southern conservatives is their continued loyalty to the Democratic Party. Most Southerners still think of themselves as Democrats, even at the moment they're pulling the lever for Richard Nixon or Ronald Reagan. Now, I would say this is 1982. This is not true anymore, and I think that's one of the great travesties of American politics. That they've some, I mean, the Republican Party has won, which is the, I mean, that's what's bulldozed the American right. There isn't a conservative party. The Republicans aren't it. The Republicans haven't flipped anything. Southern Democrats just decided they were going to vote for the Republicans because they were the more conservative of the two groups at that point. Not that they were conservative, but that they were more conservative. Part of their loyalty is an inheritance from the past. Some Southerners remember that the GOP began as a sectional party whose leaders, Fremont, Sumner, Lincoln, were bent on destroying the political influence of the South. Not forgotten either are the aggressive war ruthlessly waged by Sherman and Grant against the whole Southern people and the succeeding regional exploitation from whose effects the South is escaping only in our own generation. Some Southerners remember that the GOP began as a sectional party whose leaders, Fremont, Sumner, Lincoln, were bent on destroying the political influence of the South. Not forgotten either are the aggressive war ruthlessly waged by Sherman and Grant against the whole Southern people and the succeeding regional exploitation from whose effects the South is escaping only in our own generation. Now, this would be called lost cause mythology, and oh my gosh. But look at what happens with the Republicans now. They champion Sherman and Grant. And I mean, you've got conservatives running around saying this was good for America. You've got Alan Gelzo saying, we had two wars. We had the North won the first, the South won the second, and somehow Reconstruction is this glorious thing for America that we militarily occupied the South and at the point of a bayonet disfranchised people and forced them into political prisons and all kinds of other things. This is good. That's somehow conservative. It's an odd thing, but this is what passes for it now. You see? This allegiance to the party of their fathers is often ridiculed as the sentimentality that is to be expected from an ignorant and rustic population, despite the fact that the South is rapidly becoming far more suburban than rural. But sentimental loyalty to the past is the only secure bedrock of conservative opinions. Great line. Sentimental loyalty to the past is the only secure bedrock of conservative opinions. For the very reason that they are conservatives, most Southerners are unwilling to desert the party of Thomas Jefferson, John C. Calhoun, and Jefferson Davis, or join the party of Lincoln, Grant, and Hoover. Of course, some Republicans do remember their roots. When liberal Republicans like George Gilder, now reformed, were founding a progressive movement in the Republican Party, they called it the Ripon Society, after Ripon, Wisconsin, where the party was founded, as if to remind Republicans of their traditional commitments to social progress, liberal construction of the Constitution, and the destruction of the conservative South. No one can argue. No one is going to argue that the Mason-Dixon line forms a natural barrier between true and false conservatism. For several decades, the banner of principled conservatism has been upheld by the sage of Michigan, Russell Kirk. Even so, the South remains the nation's greatest reservoir of native conservative opinions. True, right? I mean, this is the point. This is what... He brings up Russell Kirk. That's the third way. That way is lost. We've got the West Coast Straussians arguing with the monarchists over what American conservatism means, and they're neither one of them is really American conservative. That's the problem. When you start with Lincoln, you lose. So, I mean, this is 1982, and you could have said this about Wilmore Kendall and Mel Bradford and all these people who were criticizing this start with Lincoln. I'm just going to read another couple of paragraphs. We're up on time. The real complaint against the South is that it is genuinely conservative, an intolerable situation. Consider the differences between Northern and Southern literature in our century. Works of fiction, novels, and poetry can mean more to a people than all the political manifestos and reports from all the think tanks and foundations ever established by misguided philanthropy. A people's character, at its best and worst, can be read from its novels. The modern South lives in characters like Faulkner's Rustic Gentleman, Buck and Buddy McCaslin, and the tainted heroism of Willie Stark, and the gentlemanly despair of Will Barrett. In whom Walker Percy has traced the lineaments of our modern failure of nerve, the quandary of a decent man sorting things out in a society that has rejected God. As for the serious literature of the rest of the country, I shrink from measuring a people's character by the standards of Alex Portnoy or Myra Breckinridge or Norman Mailer. If there is anywhere a vision of America where tradition and principles are at least taken seriously, it is in the best of Faulkner, Miss Flannery O'Connor, and those Southern agrarians who, in their lives and works, represented the only conservative intellectual movement taken seriously in America. I mean, this is an important point. The art of the South was genuinely conservative. It was genuinely conservative, not anything else. Whereas the art of the North isn't. When people talk about why are artists so leftist, you're not thinking about the South. You're thinking about something else. He says, Northern capitalists are apt to answer all this with the peremptory wave of the hand. It is all, they say, gone with the wind, a sentimental myth. It never occurs to them that political man lives by myths. What else but myth is the divine right of kings for which so many conservatives have spilled their blood? Or the glorious revolution, so dear to the Whigs and capitalists, with James II's Catholic heir smuggled on a warming pan? Or the myth of class struggle with students at the barricades and Joe Hill facing the firing squad. Or best of all, the courageous newspaper reporters risking the perils of wealth and fame to unmask the conspiracies of the evil Pentagon and the tyrannical Nixon. We've lost nearly all of our conservative myths. The benevolence of kings, the valor of soldiers, the piety of priests. The only real conservative myth left to Americans is the South. It's a fairy tale place of strong, courageous men and gentle but determined ladies, where the land and the family are loved more than money and productivity, where the Constitution is respected more than progress, where there are still a few churches in which the ideals of mammon are not worshipped and the social gospel not preached. What a great way to end this podcast. But, I mean, that's true, right? It's the third way. So, Lee's point was that we need to have more young conservatives thinking about the South. I agree, because here is Tom Fleming in 1982. At that point, a young conservative, he was only in his early 40s, and he was thinking about the South. Clyde Wilson in 1982 was 41 years old. Tom Fleming was around the same age. I think they're about the same. I can't remember when Tom was born, but they're about the same age, early 40s. Now, at that point, they had founded Southern Partisan. In fact, Clyde's essay, Citizens or Subjects, actually appears in one of the early issues of Southern Partisan magazine. And later on, Fleming would go to Rockford and become the editor of Chronicles. But that was coming later. At this point, he was just working with Southern Partisan. By the way, those early 80 Southern Partisans are fantastic. They're so good. But this was it. And they were thinking about these things in the 1980s as a third way. That's what we should be doing now. Forget about the West Coast Straussians. They're lost. Now, we can try to capture them. And sometimes, you know, people like Michael Anton and others will, we're going to try to come up with a Lincoln justification for secession. It's just ridiculous. They're lost. And they'll never be found because they live in the world of ideas. There's no anchor. Now, sometimes they come around to it, and Vivek Ramaswamy is doing the same thing. I mean, he can't really come to terms with this. And Anton and Ramaswamy are on the same point. Well, how can we? Because we're families of immigrants. We came over here. We don't have this anchor. We don't have that blood relation to the founding that a lot of other Americans have. True. But, I would say, and Southerners would say at the time, hey, if you move to the South, just don't rock the boat. Don't be an ideologue. And you're good. Right? Just kind of live and let live. Things are as they are. When in Rome, be as the Romans. That's not what people tend to do. Particularly ideologues who view everything through the lens of some kind of ideology, something like that. It's ridiculous. So, I love this essay. It's so good, and I wanted to bring out parts of it. Get the book, The New Right Papers. You can find it used. And start thinking about these things in a different way. The third way is what the Abbeville Institute does, is what the 1607 Project is going to do. Hopefully people like Lafayette Lee and others who have a voice now on the... I mean, they're starting to have this voice on the right, younger people thinking about these things. That would be fantastic. And we can have a new conversation about the meaning of American conservatism. See you next time with the Brian McClanahan Show. See you then.